Hello. Welcome to Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Pitts and you are listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com and on digital. On today's show, we have Raina Wynn, who is the author of the magnificent book, The Salt Path. And we also have RHS gold medal winning garden designer Lily Gomme. We've got two longer interviews from them today because they're both such incredible stories. I think they just warranted them both having a bit more time. But first, as always, we're going to have a song, and it's Angélique Kidjo with Summertime. That's Summertime by Angélique Kidjo. Glory, isn't that beautiful? Beautiful rendition of that song. I love it. I chose it when it was about 9,000 degrees, you know, not that long ago. And all of Britain was complaining about how hot it was. Because it was really hot, right? And I just wanted to go and just sit in the sea for the whole day. Thank you very much. Okay, so our first guest is Raina Wynn. I'm so pleased I got to speak to her because I just loved her book, and I met her at the Wealden Literary Festival, where there were loads of brilliant nature writers actually doing talks. If you've not been, I really recommend having a look at it, and if you're able then to go along next year. It was so nice. It was just really chilled, really relaxed, like a big summer garden party, I guess, but just listening to really interesting people who, and not just small talk over the PIMS. Her book is called The Salt Path, and it's about the story of her and her husband walking the entirety of the Southwest Coast Path, which is about 630 miles. It's no mean feat, and goes through Dorset and Devon and Cornwall and all of that. So I caught up with her on a little bench looking over a small lake, and I asked her first what it was that happened in their life which led to them in their 50s going off to walk this path. If you haven't read the book, I do have to say this interview very much contains spoilers, so sorry. And also, I will play in a minute, I have split both of the interviews that we've got coming up. I've split in two, so I'm going to play, because I wanted them to both have more time, because they're just such great stories. I didn't want to just chop it down to 10 minutes, because these are real, they're just really, they just warrant more time. They're really deep stories. I'm going to split them into and play a little song midway and then crack on with the second half. So this is the first half of the Raina Wynn interview. And like I said, I started by asking her why it was that they went off on this walk.
Well, it was a really difficult time of our lives. We were living on a little sort of farmstead in Wales with a few acres where we'd lived there for 20 years. It had been our dream home, a place we'd bought when we were in our early 30s. And it was a ruin. It needed loads of work. So we bought it with the dream of creating a little idyll where we could live life on our own terms, really. And so that's what we did. We converted the outbuildings for people to come and stay for the holidays. We kept sheep, grew vegetables, and it was our perfect life. And we lived there for, like I say, 20 years. So I was 50 then. And but in the background to our beautiful life, we'd had a financial dispute with a friend that had run on for years. And unfortunately ended in a court case that saw us being served with an eviction notice to leave our home. And that seemed like the worst thing that could possibly happen to us. Mm-hmm. Like, there was nothing worst that could ever come in our lives. But just during that awful week when we were trying to pack 20 years of family life into boxes, just 1 week to leave the house, my husband Moth had a hospital appointment that we thought was just going to be something routine, but it turned out not to be. He was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease, corticobasal degeneration, that has no treatment, no cure, and there was just nothing that could be done, except maybe a little bit of physio to keep him moving for a little longer. And I think it was at that point that I realised losing our house wasn't the worst thing. There were far worse things in life.
Wow, it's quite fascinating, those two things happen together. You have probably what would feel like the worst thing, yeah, and then immediately another level comes your way straight away. That's that's like having every rug pulled out from under your feet.
Completely. Life felt as if everything that we based it on, everything we thought our future would hold, gone in a week. Everything fell apart. And it was in that last moment, as we were about to leave the house, when the bailiffs were knocking at the door, and we were hiding under the stairs, not because we thought we would be able to avoid leaving. We knew we'd got to go, but we just weren't ready to take that final step over the threshold, knowing we'd just never, ever go back. We were hiding under the stairs, so in that moment, I saw a packing case that hadn't been taken out of the house, and on top of a pile of books in there was a book called 500 Mile Walkies by Mark Warrington. And just then, in that awful moment, the idea of just filling a rucksack and going for a walk seemed like the most obvious thing to do. And so we left that door knowing, within those few moments, knowing that we would walk the South West Coast Path.
Had you ever done anything like that before?
I think we were probably in our very early 20s when we'd backpacked a bit around the Lake District in Scotland. But then we'd had the children, and then we'd bought our place in Wales, and we hadn't done that again. So we thought it would be just the same to just fill a rucksack. But it turned out not to be the same when you're 50, as it is when you're 20.
Yeah, I'm sure. So you'd found yourself homeless. It's a huge, great big thing. So, and your whole way of seeing yourself and your identity kind of crumbles away. And then I imagine then, well, you've written about the discrepancy of how, the difference of how the public then see you and how you're seen by other people. Mm. It made it very difficult to tell people what was happening for you while you were walking the path.
Yeah, it did, because initially when we were walking, and we got these huge rucksacks on our back, so people would ask, you know, how come you've got so much time to walk such a long distance? Mm. And we, to start with, we answered quite honestly. You know, we would say, well, it's because we've lost our home. We're homeless. We've got nothing else to do. We're just walking. And we were really shocked to find that people actually physically recoiled, drew their dogs in on a retractable lead, or really gathered their children. And it was a huge surprise to us to come across that reaction, because we'd lived in a very rural place, so I hadn't really experienced homelessness. Mm. So wouldn't know the reactions that people got to being homeless. Mm. And the incredible prejudices that surround it, and the preconceptions that people carry of how someone becomes homeless, or the reasons behind it.
How were you within all of this? Because you've lost all of that stuff, you've got all this, you know, how were you both kind of coping, you know, emotionally? And
in the very early weeks, it was so hard, not just physically hard, which it is, because that path, it's remorseless. When the guidebook says it has an ascent that's equivalent to climbing Everest nearly four times, it's not kidding. It is really hard. So it wasn't just physically difficult, because, of course, Moth was really struggling physically at that time. He'd started that path barely able to put his coat on without help. So to put a rucksack on every day, get in and out of the tent, the whole palaver of camping, he was finding that really difficult. But also, we were in a really bad emotional state, because we'd had such a shock to our lives. You know, only 2 weeks earlier, we'd been living our lives in our home of 20 years, and then we were out on a path with no home, no support mechanism, just the two of us there on the cliff. And that abrupt change in life, as well as the awful diagnosis that he'd received, we weren't in the best emotional place. We were incredibly anxious and afraid, really. Mm. Afraid of what the future would hold, and how we would deal with it, and whether we'd make it through tomorrow, to be honest. So
the simplicity of just getting up every day and just walking, and that was the only thing you had to do, I mean, obviously food, but it strips things right down, doesn't it? Oh, and all, did you imagine you'd process things really quickly and it would be all of this thing happening, or actually were you just quite shut down and just focusing on one step, one step, one step?
Yeah, what we thought was, we've got this time now, we've got this mental space, we can talk through everything that's brought us to this point, we can work out how to go forwards in our future. But we didn't really talk about anything other than where the next bag of noodles was coming from, or where we were going to put the tent.
It made everything much more present. It was
Absolutely.
The immediacy of life rather
Without
than the big
doubt.
Kind of planning. And
It really became about taking the next step, about the next step and then the next step. And just to put one foot in front of another seemed to be a success in itself. But I think in doing so, that walk became almost like a walking meditation. And it allowed you your head to empty and your thoughts to clear, and that initial visceral pain of loss to start to abate, and then things changed. That's when things started to change, and that incredible strip of wilderness between the ordinary everyday on one side and that endless horizon of the sea on the other, that became the reason to go on, and that started to lead us forwards going.
Yeah, it sounded in the book, it really sounded like you gained strength as you went along, and you became much less shy of saying, yeah, we've lost our home. And, you know, and you know, because you became stronger in yourselves and able to own that part of your story.
Yes, that's right. Because for a while, we'd sort of hidden that story after those initial reactions.
It's very shaming. And it's people's response to you is very shaming. Then you kind of, recoil, don't you?
Yeah, we didn't want to feel that. We were feeling enough without adding that on as well. Mm. So we were just telling people that we'd sold our house, you know, midlife moment, going where the wind blows. And so they were all, you know, reactions were totally different then. Wow, inspirational. But after a while we stopped caring what people thought, and it didn't really matter, and we were just we are what we are.
Yeah, it's really powerful owning your own story, isn't it? Owning your own situation.
Absolutely. It gives you a strength that you think you were not going to have back, but it really does.
It's quite a story, isn't it? You know, just losing everything, your home and your partner of your lifetime, their health, you know, being diagnosed with a brain disease, and then you're just out on the path. So we're going to pick up her story again in a minute, but I'm just going to play a song just to break up the interview a little bit. And this is Eliza Gilkison with Coast.
I think I'll go down to the coast for a while. Find a little cabin by the sea. I think I need to be alone for a while. Find out whatever became of me.
That was Eliza Gilkison and Coast. So at the end of that last little segment with Raina, we could hear that the fear had started to abate a little bit and hope was starting to come back, which was a lovely turning point in their story. Here now, I'm going to pick up in the second half of this interview with Raina, where I start out here by just asking a little bit more about what it was to be wild camping that whole stretch of really quite rugged coastland. So you wild camped all of it, most of it, all of it?
All of it.
Yeah. Which is such a different way of... That in itself is such a different way of experiencing anything, because you're completely immersed in nature. And there's no separation, you know, even on a campsite, which is still outside and all of that, it's still quite sanitized. Mm. How has your experience and relationship with nature changed? And, you know, has it been massively kind of enriched and deepened as a result of, or was that something that you had anyway?
I think to an extent I had it anyway, because I grew up on a farm. I lived a very rural life. So I was always in the natural environment. So to a degree, I think wild and natural environment really was my safe place. It was the place I would go to when life didn't go the way you wanted it to. But wild camping on those cliffs, that was a wholly different experience, because you weren't just living alongside nature or in nature, you were part of it. You were absolutely part of everything that went around you. And just having those couple of layers of tent around you didn't separate you from the badger coming in through the tent flaps, or waking in a meadow where there are just thousands of ladybirds hatching into the first flight. And I think it was those magical, close moments with nature that allowed us to heal, really, because we may have had no home, we may have had absolutely nothing materially, but when we opened those tent flaps every day, we had it all. Mm. We had everything. Mm. And to just wake on a foggy headland, to hear the seals calling to each other in the coves below as the lights coming up, just lighting the headlands one by one, That's really intense in that connection to the natural world. Mm. And that allowed us to re-find our sense of self-belief.
Did you get any more spiritual? You know, because there's all these lovely stories that happened along the way when you felt really bad. I remember one that you wrote about where you hadn't had any water and it was so hot, it was like 37 degrees, and you saw on the map that there was a stream and a toilet, but the toilet was locked and the stream had run dry. I can't do it. And then someone came along and said, oh, I'm just 20 minutes up the road to have a lolly and come and have dinner. You know, things like that kind of happen quite a lot. Yeah, did you start sort of trusting something else in a way?
Well, a few people have asked me that. And it's quite tricky. I mean, I have no religious belief whatsoever. Yeah. And I wouldn't have called myself a spiritual person. Yeah. But I think... give yourself up to life and things will come. That if I came out of it with any belief at all, it was probably that allow life to be and things will come to you.
And one of the stories like that was meeting this lady who had somewhere for you to rent. Yes. that you'd walk the whole path. You met this lady on a bench and she said, oh, well, I've got somewhere to rent. How was the transition from living that wildly and being that connected? You know, you say about opening the tent flap and it's all there in front of you, and it starts to be actually a really enjoyable thing, from going from being this awful, anxious, intense thing to being actually, look at this is amazing, we're alive and aren't we lucky. How was the transition back into being into four walls?
Very difficult. Very, very difficult to go back into four walls, but not just that, to go back into society and people. I found that a very, very hard transition. And we sort of, for the first few weeks, months maybe, did find that we got the tent up in the corner of the bedroom and we were sleeping in the tent.
Oh,
just
brilliant.
Because it felt safe. But I found that really quite hard, and that's something I'm writing about in the next book.
Oh, great. There's going to be another book. Oh, back into life.
Back into life, yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So in that kind of recoiling back and just adjusting, is that where the writing started to come through?
It did, yes. It was in that time of finding it difficult to be amongst people, and a lot of introspective reflection on myself, and on that led back to thinking again about the path and the walk we'd taken. And I think I realised then it hadn't been just a physical journey, it had been a hugely emotional journey. And as I started to look back through the guidebook, then we had all the notes written in the margins of the guidebook. And I thought, I'm going to write these up. I'm going to keep these notes so that when Moth's disease started to take his memory, I'd have something to put in front of him and say, look what we did, you know, remember this, keep trying. But very quickly, those notes just turned into narrative, and then I was writing a book. And 5 months later, I got the first draft. So, yeah.
And that's just something you'd never done before, never written before, and that's quite incredible.
No, I think when I was a child, I thought, I wanted to grow up and be a writer and have a penguin on the spine of my book. But, you know, life gets in the way and I did other things and it didn't happen. So when I did actually start to write, it was like a whole lifetime maybe of thinking, yeah, I should have done.
So, in a way, the path led you back to your
yes.
actual, your real path.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yes, the path led me where I was meant to go, maybe.
Yeah. And now you're a public figure. You've got this massively public life. I mean, what a transformation, what a transition, what a change from where you were to here. How does that feel?
I think even now I'm finding it quite hard to really grasp. When I go to the publishers, they say, you don't quite get how big this is now. And I think I don't. Mm. I think I just keep going and having a chat about walking a nice long distance.
Probably good to keep it like that, otherwise yeah. It might all just get a bit too big and a bit scary.
Yeah, it's probably the best way.
Book two.
I'm writing it now. I'm into it now. But it's supposed to be published in the spring next year. Okay. So fingers crossed.
Any more information
on
that?
It's very much about that strong connection to the natural environment. It's about the transition back into real life, or out of real life, back into society, however you see it. And a very strange offer that came from someone who read The Salt Path.
Ooh, are we leaving that there?
We'll leave that there.
Oh, I can't wait. And how do you feel about the South West Coast Path now? What are your feelings towards this 630-mile stretch that goes along the edge of the land?
Yeah, I love that path. It's I feel almost physically attached to it. And still now when I go there and I'm on that little foot wide strip of land and you can smell the sea and you can hear the gulls and there's that ozone wind comes up over the cliff, it's like, yes, I'm home.
So that was Raina Wynn and some of her story. The book goes into it so much more, and if you haven't read it, I really recommend it. I promise I'm not on commission or anything. It's just a really great book. There's so much in there that I loved, that bit about just giving yourself up to life and things will come to you. Oh, beautiful. So true. So hard to achieve, and yet so true. So the common thread that's between these two interviewees, between Raina and between Lily, when life doesn't go the way you think it's going to be and all of the rugs just get pulled out from under your feet, you know, what are you going to do? What do you do? What do you do next? And then for these two, how the healing power of being in nature or being outside is kind of what helped them get through all of this stuff. So we're going to hear more about Lily's story in a moment. But first we'll have a song, and it's Eva Cassidy with Wade in the Water.
Who's that yonder dressed in white? Wading the water must be the children of the Israelite. Oh, God's gonna trouble the water. Wading the water, wading the water, children, wading in the water. God's gonna trouble the water.
That was Eva Cassidy with Wade in the Water. You're listening to Radio Reverb. I'm Charlotte Petts and this is Growing Wild. Okay, so my next interviewee is Lily Gom. She's a garden designer. She's designed at RHS Tatton. She's a Silver Gilt winner at Hampton Court for a garden that was absolutely brilliant, I thought. And this year she won gold at Chelsea for her display with Still and Hillier. She's only 30 years old, so she's doing pretty well. So I met her at Chelsea this year and had a little interview with her then, and we just sort of got chatting really since then and started to find out a bit more about her story. And it's such an incredible story that we talked about it a bit and we thought it'd be quite a nice thing to share. This is more about her life, I guess, and how it is that she arrived at becoming a garden designer, and a very good one at that. So here we go. She is on a bench in Regent's Park and on the phone. And I should say that we do talk a lot about grief and death in this interview. So if that's a situation that is difficult for you at the moment, then that's just a heads up. So this is the first part. And I started out by asking her if garden design was something that she knew she'd always wanted to do.
Not in any way. It really sort of came to a head when I was a gardener. About 5 years ago, I just started out and I'd studied design, and that urge to you know, create something crept in again, and that's when I actually saw the Young Designer competition. And so prior to that point, I hadn't at all.
Wow, so that sort of came from, it sounds like it came from nowhere almost. It was just a little spark of inspiration.
sort of. I loved gardens. I loved being in them. And I think from working and maintaining a lot of quite well-known designers' gardens themselves, I wanted to have a go myself.
Okay. So where did? Yeah. What about gardening then? With not the design, just the gardening. Where did that come in? Is that something you've grown up with?
It was. So I had my dad was just a lover of gardening, and I could always see how happy it made him. He was always happiest with like weeding with one hand and a beer in the other. So content. So that's what I grew up with. But it was really after he passed away that I came back to the garden, and it was a real turning point. And ever since then, I just sort of figured out that I could do that every day, and plants were my real passion, and I'd got it wrong previously.
Okay, so it's something that you used to do with your dad, and then he passed away, and then you went straight back into the garden. Was that to help you kind of just to remind you of him? Did it feel like a connection to him, or was it that it was outside and that it gave you a bit of space?
It's, well, after he passed away, and the following summer, like, the garden looked awful, and it's just there were more things that were slowly I was realizing that I'd lost as a result of losing that person as well, and that connection to nature was one of them. So as it looked so bad, I thought I'd have to get out there myself to do something about it, and that's I really sort of almost found I found peace and quiet in the garden in a time which was quite turbulent. I'd spent the past few years, I'd lost a few family members, many things had gone wrong, and it was like white noise in a way, and no one else that I knew liked gardening, so they left me to it, and it was just quiet and what I needed.
Did you feel confident in the garden? Were you like able, or was it sort of starting from scratch and having to learn everything, or had your dad taught you quite a lot previously?
Well, he'd taught me stuff, but the difference was I didn't have him to ask questions to anymore. Mm. And I think that was the frustrating thing. So there was lots of swearing and not knowing whether something was quite a weed or not, or especially when, you know, seedlings are coming through, it's hard to tell when you're a novice. So yeah, lots of teaching myself. All I did was grow vegetables for a while. So many, it was ridiculous. And then went on to study horticulture.
What were you doing before that?
I just finished my degree, and then for work I'd actually moved away from the subject that I was studying. So I studied architecture, but then needed a little break because I realised that wasn't quite right, and I worked in a care home for people with cerebral palsy.
Okay.
Which was obviously very, very different, but it's just, I've always enjoyed caring. So
had you gone home to care for your dad?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was sort of a strange time where everything was up in the air. I no longer had the path that I thought I was going to go on, and my degree was sort of broken almost, because in my third year, which I had to take over 2 years, I moved home to care for my dad and my nan, and after losing him I lost that purpose, and it was really strange waking up and not having someone else to care for. So directly just took that to this care home,
because I guess you get used to putting someone else's needs before your own. They're your first thought of the day. You know, what do they need? And you get a bit lost within that.
Yeah, completely
yeah.
lost.
Yeah. So you took it to the care home, but I imagine that feeling of trying to find out who you were doesn't really leave, does it? It sort of starts bubbling and growing in you, and you've kind of got to start paying attention to that eventually, because we can only ever put other people first for a certain amount of time before we start to go a bit mad. Is that fair?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think when those family members did eventually pass away, that's what you're left with, that you sort of have to get back to you. That's quite hard to actually figure out exactly what you want and almost be brave enough to go and do it at the same time.
Mm.
I find that hard, stepping away from architecture, because, you know, you've told people that you're going to do something, you've spent a lot of money on a degree, and then, you know, I've suddenly spent the next chapter of my life caring for people, which is just so dramatically different.
Yeah,
I think you have to justify everything.
I know, because there's such an expectation that you should just know what you want to do. I think we get funneled through the education system, like, well, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? And it, I don't know that anyone can know when they're 18, 19. It's such a big decision.
No, no.
And yeah,
I wish I'd taken more time over that decision.
Right.
I was going to say, at my school, if I hadn't have gone to university, I would have been one of very few people that weren't. And it's almost like a direct path or a stigma if you don't.
So after your dad died, and who were the other family members?
I lost my aunt and my great uncle, who was like my granddad, and my nan, who I grew up living with.
Right. But, gosh, yeah. All in what space of time?
So that would be over about 3 years.
Goodness me. And you were in your early 20s?
I was 23 when my dad passed.
Right. That's quite a load to carry on such young shoulders.
I mean, I'm grateful that I lost them at that age. I can't imagine what it'd be like to be any younger.
Mm.
But yeah, it's sort of that pivotal time where you're trying to figure out who the hell you are.
Mm. Yeah. And after it happened, how were your connections with the other members of your family? Was it, you know, did you all kind of get through it together? Did you come together? Were you quite well supported in that respect?
Well, it's kind of a difficult time added to by the fact that I'd just come out, which hadn't gone well.
How did you not explode?
How it's, I know.
So much.
I just buried it deep.
Okay. Just tuck it in. Right. Yeah,
that was 2 months before my dad passed. So, yeah, it was a very strange time and an odd atmosphere, but also you still want to look after the people that are grieving. So, I don't know, put someone else first instead of me. The recurring theme.
It is, isn't it? How are you with that these days? Are you kind of more front of the queue now?
Yeah.
I think it takes a lot of unlearning how to do that.
Yeah, it's not selfish to know what you want and to do what makes you happy.
So yeah, it's a lot, isn't it? She had a lot there in her early 20s. Goodness me, if you think you're on a path somewhere and then all those close people, you know, so many of them died in such a short space of time, to find your way through that is quite remarkable. We'll come to part two of that interview in a moment, but I'm just going to play a song first, and it's Landslide by Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, mirror in the sky, what is can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my life?
That was Landslide by Fleetwood Mac. I don't think I can quite get through that song without welling up. It just gets me. It's just one of those songs, it just gets me. Okay, so I'm going to pick up with the second half of Lily's interview. You could just hear it starting to turn at the end there, where she's starting to put herself first and figure out what it is that she wants to do. So we pick up here with me asking a little bit more about what it was that the significance of the garden brought to her. Did being in the garden... was there something about being able to, this might sound horribly cheesy, but you're kind of growing life and then it dies and you're kind of part of this cycle. You can kind of see it happening in nature, in the garden. Did that help at all? You know, did you feel that kind of reflecting your experience a little bit? Was that helpful? Was it cathartic? Or was it just the fact that it was physical and it was outside and it was a connection to your dad?
It was cathartic. I loved it. And I think when I did lose him, we also lost all the stuff that came with the garden. So the first thing I did was start growing runner beans, because they were always sort of a part of my childhood that I hadn't really thought much about. But when they're suddenly taken away and you don't have these moments, I needed to recreate them. So I started growing them myself. And that first time a plant died, I remember standing in the potting shed and just crying because it just made everything feel okay, which is quite a strange thing as you're killing a plant, but not intentionally. There was a wholesome feeling about it.
And you mentioned that it just all felt like white noise. When did that start to abate? And when did, you know, a bit more clarity come?
That came with sort of realising, well, to be honest, I'd never thought about horticulture as a career option. And I think once it changed from being a hobby and a sort of little own sanctuary that I created for myself, that I could actually extend that and do that every day. Which, once I realised that, just, it was ridiculous. Like, why wasn't it obvious years ago? I don't ever remember it being sort of promoted at school as an option. You could be a gardener. It was always something that I kept quiet. You're not going to go and tell your friends when you're 14 that you spent the weekend at a nursery. That kind of...
It's just not cool.
No, it's not cool.
Yeah, it's not common. And I don't know if you've noticed that changing recently. Do you see that being any different now?
Actually, I helped out a community scheme for schools and promoting gardening through the RHS last year. And the enthusiasm that these kids had for these gardens that they were designing was just incredible. And all of us that were there judging and giving comments were just wishing that we had that back in the day. Mm. And it would have made such a difference. So yeah, it's coming through.
Is that something you'd like to do more of? Encouraging children and involving children in the garden, is that?
I think so, yeah.
Because you're achieving such like great things.
A whole job in itself.
Oh, I know. Because once you've got a gold at Chelsea, I mean, what do you want next? You know, what's left to do? Are you full of ideas? Or are you just going to change tack completely and become, you know, something else?
I'm still interested in all the things I was interested in before, but I'm on a placement at a landscape architecture company, and that's really changing my perspective on how useful I can actually be, because just getting that feeling now of everything that's coming out with climate change and our impact is that I want to not just take, I feel like all we do is take from this earth and I mean to give it back. So I'm trying to figure out how I can have a part in that.
Any ideas?
I'll let you know.
Okay.
We'll see.
Just to have such a time at such a formative and young part of your life. I know you said you're glad it didn't happen any earlier, but God, it's still really early in your life. Do you feel like that's sort of driven you now? Do you feel spurred on? Did it, the effect of losing so many lives, did that kind of make you think, God, I need to crack on and really maximise my own? You know, is that something that came up for you?
Yeah, to be honest, it completely changed me for the better. I'm a lot stronger because of it. I feel like a completely different person sometimes. I wouldn't have done the things that I've done in previous years if that hadn't have happened, because the me before that would have been too fearful to actually do it. But I don't know. I think there's nothing left to lose.
Yeah, does it remove fear?
Yeah, it did. I'd already lost so much that I'd loved that I don't know what else could hurt me as much as that. So why not try.
But how is the grieving process now? You said you buried it, you just shoved it all down. Has that been something that you've, is that coming out? Has it come out? And where, how are you doing with that?
It comes out occasionally, but it is still something that I keep to myself. It's very private, and I always think when you share, you have to share with the right person and know. It's like you're bearing your soul when you talk about these things. And even at home, we don't talk about it, which is strange. I think grief should be, it should be shared. We all go through it. And then it will be less of a shock when it does happen to someone.
Yeah, it's the most constant, it's the most reliable thing that will happen to us.
Yeah.
You know, someone we know is going to die and we're going to die.
It's hard when, so for instance, when I lost those people, none of my friends had really gone through that kind of level of grief. So there wasn't that relatable person that I could go to. Didn't want them to be going through that either, so
yeah, that's a funny place to be in.
Yeah,
kind of slightly resentful, or that's what I would imagine, like you've no idea what this feels like, but also I hope you never know what this feels like. Yeah, it's quite isolating, it sounds.
Completely. Yeah, I remember sitting in the pub with my friends and they were just having normal conversations, and but everything in my world had just broken, and you know, always kind of screaming inside. But there's nothing anyone can do,
and that's where the beauty of the outdoors comes in, and it's such a place to channel this stuff. It's a place you can really just, I don't know, like get it out of you a bit and feel kind of almost supported by that instead of by other humans. That's how I
completely
feel
agree.
Yeah,
it's calming.
It is calming. What's next for you? You've said you've just got a new job, a landscape architecture, a big firm in London, which is quite a departure from having your own business and doing that.
Well, I'm going to be here for a year, still doing my own projects alongside, and hopefully going to fit in volunteering at a garden at the same time, because I've only got a little courtyard and just my hands aren't getting dirty enough there.
Yeah, which garden do you know?
Well, I've moved to Tunbridge Wells, which is very near Sissinghurst and Great Dixter, so I'm going to see if one of those will take me.
I'm sure they will welcome you with open arms.
We'll see, hopefully.
There we go, that was Lily Gom's story. It's that theme that comes up on this show all the time of just how supporting nature can be, and the rhythms of that and kind of engaging with that can just be so helpful when we're going through difficult times. You can find out more about Lily's work. She's got a website, which is lilygom.com. So that's GOMM.com. And you can see all of her beautiful garden designs. She's a talented woman, that one. Just leaves me to say thank you to both Raina and to Lily for sharing their stories. I know, especially for Lily, she hasn't really talked about that very much. So I think that's really brave and very honest of her to talk about that. And it's just that thing of even when, you know, when life just chucks you a massive curveball, which it happens to both of these two women, sometimes you kind of find your way through it. And maybe from that you find something that you love. You know, for Raina it was writing, and for Lily it's been the garden. So you can get in touch with me if you wish on social media. I am on Instagram at Growing Wild FM. I occasionally pop up on Twitter, but I don't like it. But you can find me on at Growing Wild FM again. You can email the show at growingwildreverb.com, or you can find the show via the show pages on www.radioreverb.com. Thank you for listening. I'm going to play out with a song with a little bit of it's got a bit of gusto behind it. I went to the press night, the opening night of Oklahoma the musical. I love a musical in Chichester, and it was just so fun. It was just the nicest. It was just really fun, and I love this song. It's just so full of hope and wonder at our beautiful world. So I'm going to play you out with "Oh What a Beautiful Morning" from the Oklahoma soundtrack. Have a great month. Go well. Thank you for listening. See you next time.
The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks
looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky.